You're listening to the Common Descent Podcast. Hello, Dylan.
Hello, David. Hello, Will.
Hello, Will.
Hello, David. Hello, Dylan.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Common Descent Podcast. This is a podcast about paleontology, evolution, life history, but this is our special series, Spotlight 2024, where we are sitting down to chat about science communication with a bunch of our fellow science communicators, fellow podcasters in paleontology and related fields. This episode, we're joined by Dylan. Hello, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Before we get into our main discussion, please, if you would introduce yourself and your podcast for our listeners.
Absolutely. As you said, my name is Dylan Wilmeth. I am a visiting assistant professor at Grand Valley State University in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And my podcast is Bedrock, Earth's Earliest History. And it is about the first 90% of history on Earth.
Yeah, all the stuff that we on our Common Descent so readily ignore when we get caught up talking about dinosaurs and stuff.
Well, and I love the description, the first 90% of Earth history, because that really puts it in perspective. And I love that.
Yes.
Yeah, like you see these shirts and there's like these classic Ray Troll shirts with like the column of like the all the different eras and periods. And then way crammed at the bottom is the Precambrian, the Proterozoic, and the Archean. And honestly, that's how a lot of like researchers think about it too. Most folks focus on the very exciting, you know, last 10%. But if you were to have that shirt, should really be a skirt or a dress, right? If you wanted to have that to really, you know, do it true service.
I used to do, we would do lab programs or educational programs at the museum with a timeline. And it would be like a two-scale timeline where it's like 1 millimeter is a million years or whatever, something like that. And the timeline was almost always just the Phanerozoic back to the Cambrian. And then I remember I would have it laid out across like four tables in the lab. And then I'd bring the group down to the end and I'd say, oh, and if this went to the actual beginning of Earth, it would end in the middle of the street out there.
Yes.
Way out in that direction.
Yep.
Absolutely. Well, I do something a little bit similar. I don't talk about it too much on the show, but I'm focused on all of Earth history, but that's not all of the universe's history, right? Mm-hmm, so 4.5 billion, 4.6 billion versus 13.7, I think, billion. So I say, well, if the calendar, the Earth calendar is 1 year, you know, we got to go back a couple of years before the Big Bang. And I don't touch that stuff. That's for another podcast.
Yep.
So if our listeners, after hearing our chat with you, are inclined to go check out your podcast, what might they expect? What's the vibe? Describe it for us.
Yeah, so the vibe, each episode is between 15 minutes and half an hour long. It's just me speaking, but I do try to spice it up. I have a lot of interstitial music and sound effects to spice things up. So it's not just me lecturing as if you were in a classroom. If you were to look at the broad span of it, I truly start from the beginning and I'm going forward over time. So if you want to just hunt and peck different portions, you can absolutely do that. If you want to just binge it all from the beginning, you totally can. So right now we're in what I call season two, the Eoarchean. We're about 3.8 billion years old. Each episode focuses on a specific topic. Like we're going to get into banded iron formations. So we cover like what these things are and perhaps even more importantly, why should I care? Like, why do I care about a bunch of like red and black striped rock? Well, everything you know that is made of steel comes from rocks that are billions of years old. And it's like, we think of great iron, but that iron, most of these mines come from extremely old deposits. And it's, I like to throw in like economics, geopolitics, culture in there whenever possible.
Yeah. These rocks just haven't, they didn't just appear, like they came from a long time ago, very ancient processes.
Absolutely.
I really, I like connecting it to the way it functions today, you know, the way we interact with it today.
Yeah. And sometimes I'll take a detour like, okay, well, to learn about any sort of context here, we have to go back and like review plate tectonics or the three different types mm-hmm. of rocks. And let's say if you come in, if you just want to dive in halfway through and I say, well, we've talked about this topic. I always try to say, well, we talked about this topic on X podcast episode a long time ago. So you can back up, you can refer. It almost feels like the longer I go, half the episode will just be, well, we talked about this and this and this episode. I try to do some more succinct recaps as well. Yep.
That is a very familiar feeling. Yep. Where we have, it becomes very nice eventually because you start to hit an episode where you go, oh, this topic is going to be really daunting. Oh, wait, this whole half of the topic is another episode that yes. we already did. It's very freeing.
Exactly. Sort of like starting and building the listener's confidence over time is a good feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're starting, I think, to get a sense of this, but I wanted to ask directly, in your mind, what is the mission or the goal behind Bedrock?
The mission behind Bedrock is this. I was a dinosaur kid growing up. Mm-hmm. I tell my history in the first episode. And if you would have asked me even 10 or 12 years ago what I'd be doing, I would have said, absolutely, you know, dinosaurs, no question. And if you told me that I'd instead be working on rocks 3 billion, 4 billion years old, I would have just laughed out loud. And part of that was because I'd never been exposed to these types of rocks. I didn't know what was going on back then. You know, I grew up with Walking with Dinosaurs and all these dinosaur books. And the oldest for me was, you know, the Paleozoic. But the more I learned about this ancient world and a lot of mysteries with it, that got me fascinated. And as I became a PhD student and then a postdoctoral researcher and talking to people, they would just be really interested in this period of time that they had never heard of before. And I realized, well, I think I've got a story to tell. I can start at the beginning and go forward, and I know it's a daunting task. Sort of the inspiration for this. During the pandemic, I got hooked onto a lot of history podcasts, actually, the history of Egypt, the history of England. And they just start from the beginning and go forward. And like, I can do that with Earth. Absolutely. So, the goal is to highlight this huge period of time that very few people talk about, but has a lot of cool stories.
Absolutely.
It is a very admirable task.
Mm-hmm.
And it is absolutely, we were talking about it before, and I think that it bears repeating that truly 90% of Earth history gets, if we're generous, 10% of the attention
yeah.
in a lot of science communication and even a lot of science research.
Absolutely. And there are some other reasons for that. Like if you just take the first half of Earth history, that's at best 10% of the continental surface, and even probably less than that. Mm-hmm. We're not working mm-hmm. with a lot of material to begin with. And I think a lot of people just think, oh, it's just bacteria, right? But right. Yes. I mean, they led eventually along the way, you know, to us. And also, you know, I like to breathe. I hope you all do too. That started with life. Just to me, the story of Earth is the story of life. Now I'm biased. If this was being done by like a, what we call a hard rock person, you know, like somebody very into tectonics or volcanoes, they would probably tell the story. The broad beats would be similar, but in a slightly different way. So I acknowledge that, but I think life is cool. And most people seem to agree with me there.
So I would love to expand upon the topic. And as soon as we reached out and invited you to join us on this podcast, this is the question that I wanted to ask and spur this discussion. You have elected to do the daunting task of doing an entire podcast about, forgive me, I don't mean the words that I say, the most boring parts of Earth history. It's the parts without any dinosaurs. There's no humans. There's not even like recognizable fossils for most people. Mm-hmm. And of course, obviously, there's a whole podcast to be had of it. You speak very passionately about it. Mm-hmm. I would love to talk about the challenges or perhaps also the benefits of science communication when the topic is something that people aren't already interested in or are predisposed to think is uninteresting.
That's not already popular like dinosaurs are.
Yeah,
totally. I can absolutely dive in on that. So even for people who work in this time, there are segments called The Boring Billion. We haven't gotten there yet.
We did an episode on The Boring Billion.
No joke. There are decent chunks, although people are, you know, anybody who works in that time period is always going to fight back on you on that. But I absolutely understand what you're saying. You know, if you show folks, you know, Jurassic Park versus, yep, that sure is some pond scum over there. The cell is pretty tough. So you try to find whatever diamonds in the rough that you can. It's pretty, for the first season or two, a lot of the hooks are, this is the oldest X, the oldest Y. Mm-hmm. And people always want to know what the oldest of something or the most of something is.
Yeah, the record holders.
The record holders. Yeah, I call it the bottom of the cookie jar, right? Let's see what we can get. And to broaden that out to the podcast as a whole, people want to know where they came from. Mm-hmm. I think I give this analogy in episode one that, you know, you go over your family photo albums, you look at cemeteries, you look at record logs if you're interested in, and even if you're not really that nitty gritty into your parents or grandparents, something about your heritage. Most people are interested in that. So I try to sell this story as the heritage of not just you, the listener, but of all the world around you. When I finished season one, I said, well, now we know where the moon came from, where the oceans came from, right? I try to pick tangible things around you that you can point to and say that formed X billion years ago. Or even if you can't remember the numbers, remember the Earth calendar, like January, February on the Earth calendar. People have always asked where things came from. I'm hugely interested in where things come from. So that's a huge tack I try to put into it as far as the origin of everything.
Well, and I really like that approach because a lot of those, you know, people will always have fun with finding out what the oldest of a thing is and, you know, learning the origin. But a bunch of those things are things that I know lots of people never question the origin. Like, you know, where did the ocean come from? What do you mean?
Right.
It's the ocean. Mm-hmm. It's always been.
Right. That question by itself is a hook because it's a question a person may never have thought about
before. Exactly. And so you're getting to actually answer those questions and reveal that, yeah, no, there was a time before oceans.
Yeah. When did the atmosphere begin?
Yes.
When did rocks, when did continents begin? Those are really incredible questions to think that you could even ask, or even better than that, answer.
Yes.
That's a great way to put it. As far as a hook is literally shaking someone's bedrock, if you'll pardon the pun. about the world. It's like, oh, wait, that thing wasn't around. And even if that was a long time ago, that like almost like missing a step that you're used to taking every day. It's like, wait, okay, so how did it get here? And bringing them in. And then there are actually, I'd say, plenty of very exciting topics in the Precambrian that no one really talks about or is sort of vaguely in the background. Like, one of the highlights of season one, the Hadean, is the moon formation. Like, an object the size of Mars, spoiler alert, comes out of this great cosmic billiard board that is the early solar system and gives us this huge chip shot. That in itself is like just nuts to think that another planet hit us. It's the stuff of science fiction movies, and yet it happened, and we can see the evidence for that every day. And the other side of that is I like to usually list how we got to that point because it took a while for us to realize this. I list how Charles Darwin's son, George Darwin, came up with an alternative hypothesis back in the day that the Earth was spinning like a really fast, soft clay pot and it sort of, you know, blobbed out the moon on its own.
Yes.
So another hook is trying to bring in historical figures and also trying to show that scientists usually didn't get it right the first time, and we're still arguing a lot about it now, that it is still a very malleable process.
Yeah, it is a very satisfying approach to tie the history of the Earth with the history of the science of us understanding that story.
Mm-hmm. And you get repeat characters showing up every so often. And this isn't exactly answering your question, but I'm learning about figures who I did not learn about as an undergrad or even a PhD student. People like Marie Tharp, you know, describing the seafloor, mapping mid-ocean ridges. And there's a lot of other people important in that too. But so I teach in Michigan, and Marie Tharp was a Michigander. She's born there originally. Oh, and cool. So I ask the crew how many folks have heard about her, maybe one or two students. And so I say, well, I didn't learn about her, but you get to now. And people are hooked. Inge Lehmann, this Danish woman who discovered Earth's inner core. So telling folks that I'm learning about this stuff sometimes at the same time as you are tries to show that, you know what? It's this organic, dynamic, messy process. And there's a lot of people who need to be brought up to the spotlight, I think.
Yeah, there it is. Fantastic to think about presenting people with information you've never heard about from a time period you never hear about that was discovered by this person you've never heard
about. Yes,
exactly.
Right. All of these underrepresented aspects of the science get to come out in those stories.
And in a few cases, a person that they maybe have heard about. We just talked about Carl Sagan in one of our most recent episodes. And everybody knows Carl Sagan, Mr. Cosmos. You know, I mean, I was hooked on Cosmos, got those VHS tapes from the library growing up. Huge influence on my method of science communication. But not a lot of folks know that one of his bread and butter papers was looking at the ancient Earth's atmosphere and trying to figure out why Earth wasn't a frozen popsicle for half its history. Still, people to this day cite that Sagan paper as an influential influence on early Earth history.
Cool. Yeah, I think the angle of tying in these, like you said before, Will, tying in these things from way in the past, these underrepresented topics in science, to their relevance today, to people today, to things that we experience today, is a really great way to hook people. And it is an effective counter to what we were saying before, referring to these topics as something people aren't already interested in. Because with dinosaurs, I often like to say that if you're teaching vertebrate paleontology, half the work is done for you.
Yes.
Because who doesn't like dinosaurs? That's already out there. But what you're describing is finding the aspects that people are already interested in. There is already that connection. It might not be as obvious. You might have to think about it for a second. But finding that connection that then brings people's, you actually do care about these ancient rocks. You just didn't know that you cared about it yet. Here's that information.
And sometimes that brings in people more than the charismatic megafauna. We're on a different level, right? Like, you know, dinosaurs, they're great. I still love dinosaurs. But for folks who are looking for something a little bit, you know, more obscure, you know, for the real hunter, treasure hunters out there. I think that's the Precambrian's a great place. Lots of hidden treasure.
Well, and it's, you know, we were talking earlier about like shaking up people's perception of Earth. That so often the Earth is seen as a fairly static thing. Like the continents have moved around and temperatures have changed, but it's mostly been the same kind of planet that life has been changing on is very often the mentality you can get and come away from if you're only learning about things after the Cambrian. This really emphasizes that Earth has been changing. And you mentioned early on that it also connects it with our solar system and the greater aging of the aging of our planet was also because our solar system at one point was young and messy. And that's why we got a moon. Like, had the Earth formed somehow magically in a an already set solar system, we might not have ever gotten a moon because nothing would have run into us. And that it's kind of connecting all these dots that oftentimes can kind of remain in bubbles when they're discussed. Mm-hmm. Like the formation of Earth gets discussed, and then time happened, and then life happened. But really, there's stuff all throughout that yada yada so that people usually skip over. That's really interesting. And I appreciate that it seems like you're very often trying to connect as many dots as you can with these things.
Yeah, I think what you just mentioned, the example of life, like Earth starts, blah, blah, blah. Life starts very often how it's taught. But I've got about a 6 or 7 episode arc on the origin of life. You have to have that many episodes just to set up folks with the biology. But at the beginning, I talk a lot about asteroids, because that carbon didn't just come from, you know, out of thin air. It came from carbonaceous chondrites, from asteroids pelting the Earth. And I try very hard to say that it didn't bring, you know, life itself, but it brought the building blocks, and surprisingly complex ones at that. I believe, I'm not sure if I mentioned it directly on the show, but individual nucleobases, or the origins of nucleobases, can be found on some of these asteroids. Certainly very primitive lipids, very primitive carbohydrates, more complex than you would expect.
Yeah, which is so crazy.
Yeah, I know. Again, that was a part I learned a lot about, as far as how did it build up from, you know, in space, and then the hydrothermal systems. It's a crazy story.
I like that we started with the prompt of, it can be hard to do science communication on topics that are underappreciated or undersold. And the conversation has been almost entirely positive stuff.
Yes.
Because I was waiting. I was going to say, let's talk about the challenges and then we can talk about the benefits. But it really, if you come at it the right way, it's all benefits.
Mm-hmm.
It's all showing people things they hadn't thought about, connecting those dots that people aren't already appreciating. And I think you're coming at it from this very, and I think our conversation in general is coming at it from this very positive and helpful atmosphere. And I want to stress this part, because we have people listening who I know, we have people who listen who are SciComers, who are interested in hearing these discussions about how to think about communicating and teaching science. And I think it's a great model to be like, well, yeah, we're not complaining about it. We're finding mm-hmm. all the exciting parts of it the whole time.
Well, and it's because, and this is often the point I would try to get across when like training tour guides and stuff, that, and it's what you and I started the podcast very much with, the mentality of, it all is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, any topic you decide to dive in on is interesting, especially if you ask the right people who already are interested in it. You just have to find those parts that spark the interest. But I mean, it already is interesting. It's just, if you're not prepped for it and you are stuck in the mentality of that it's one of the boring topics,
right,
it can be harder. But once you can get past that preconception that dinosaurs are the most interesting fossil and the others aren't,
mm-hmm.
well, then you can immediately start looking at other stuff and going, well, no, there's obviously something interesting. Someone out there is studying it.
And I remember when I was in grad school, when I became a grad student, I was assigned to, you're going to be teaching the labs for this intro geology class. And the labs were, you know, it was minerals. And I was like, that's cool. I can teach minerals are awesome. There's all sorts of cool stuff. And sedimentary rocks. Great. Best rocks. Fossils. All the good stuff. And then igneous rocks. And I was like, cool. If I can make volcanoes boring, I should just leave. And then metamorphic rocks. And I had to have a moment where I was like, all right, I need to get excited about metamorphic rocks, because
yes.
I am not right now excited about it. And I had to go online and be like, all right, let me look up like nerds talking about metamorphic rocks. Dylan, have you found ever that there are topics that come across in your podcast or in your teaching where even you, with your deep passion for the deepest parts of Earth history, have to sort of look at a thing and go, ooh, I don't actually care about this thing, but now I have to figure it out?
It's interesting you mentioned the labs. I also find the metamorphic rocks lab kind of the hardest to go through. The way I try to sell that is like, this rock here that I'm holding in my hand, and it's got these zebra stripes of black and white, used to be this rock over here that looks completely different. But even so, it's like, okay, cool, that one rock looked like this other rock, and this happened in a realm that we can never see. And that being said, most Precambrian rocks are metamorphic rocks. So
right.
I try to focus more on the original story than what's happened afterwards. But I did have to learn quite a bit about this for the oldest rocks on Earth, the Acasta gneiss. The gneiss is about as much as you can pressure cook a rock until it is, you know, either too hot and becomes lava, or, you know, there's a whole bunch of other things. And I guess I thought I was too cool for gneiss as well. and I'll, again, as I believe I've mentioned before, I don't go as in depth into, like, I talk about plate tectonics. I do talk about like magma stuff. And like, you're right, volcanoes themselves, like the actual like eruption and all that devastation and the surface processes, I think are very cool. sometimes I find myself struggling a little bit with the magma chamber stuff. Now, part of that is due to ignorance, and I'm learning a lot. And the more I'm learning, the more I was like, oh, that's cool, and that's cool. And I'm sure there's maybe some igneous people out there shaking their fist at me. Well, I'd say to them, come on, and I'll interview you on the show.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that it's an important piece to remember of the SciComm story. And it's the thing that I always tell when I train tour guides and such. If you're not interested, no one else is going to be interested in hearing you talk about it. That enthusiasm comes through and it has to be there. And so you do have to find that angle for yourself. Yep. You have to get excited before you can really effectively communicate that what's exciting about something.
Yeah. Not only is that enthusiasm contagious, but people can tell when it's lacking.
Yes, we've all been to college.
Yep.
We know what it's like when you're listening to someone who doesn't want to be there talking about stuff they don't want to talk about.
Mm-hmm. And I try to include that enthusiasm as much as possible in the classroom itself. And the reviews from the students seem to reflect that. So it seems to be going well so far. I'm a theater kid to begin with in high school. And I remember always getting the butterflies in the stomach before I was on stage, but then being on stage felt very natural. The first semester or two, it felt very similar as far as just like, okay, getting over the nerves and then getting up there, and it felt very natural. Some people may agree or disagree on this. I'm curious what you guys think as far as, I think there is a little bit of performance in good science communication. Enthusiasm is one word for it, but I wouldn't say I put on like I'm not a different character when I'm when I'm teaching or when I'm podcasting. Mm-hmm. But I'm definitely conscious of the engagement action, like pulling people in with the tone of my voice, the speed of my voice, the actions that I do if I'm actually in person. I'm curious what you two think about that.
For sure, there is an aspect of performance. We often call it tour guide mode for the way we do it. That we kind of maintain our podcast with the same energy and approach that we would if we had a group of people following us around through the conversation. And that, it's a different speaking cadence and tone and approach than I would do if I was just in my pajamas and we were talking about it down in my living room.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't have to be a performer to be an effective communicator, but I do think that you have to perform.
You have to be on.
You have to be ready to perform. It's that fine line that comes up. This comes up in other conversations in this series, that space where entertainment meets education. Mm-hmm. And we try to, there has to be a balance there.
Yes.
So I think, and it's something that's really important to keep in mind for us as communicators that, you can't just turn on a mic and speak as though you normally if you speak as though no one's listening, then you lose some of the ability to make that connection. And it's also important to remember when we're listening to people who are doing communication that they are putting on some of that, you put on the teacher mask or you put on the tour guide performance. It is done up a bit. There's some pizzazz on this experience that you're getting.
I'm going to laugh along with you all at the joke I just made, but that's the 50th time I've made that joke.
Yes.
kind of stuff. I want it to feel organic for you so that you are enjoying it and you're engaged, but no, I no longer find that joke as funny as I did it the first time I did it.
Listen, you can't take these jokes for granted.
Yes.
I can't count how many times I've said that joke. It still makes me chuckle a little bit, but I do know what you mean. Everybody groans when they say it, but I don't care.
Yes.
And sometimes if you're giving these talks and lectures over and over again, you might not have the luxury of there are some days when I come into a lecture and maybe I've just had not really a great day or I'm extra stressed and all that. And I still try to put on as much as I can. I don't try to like completely mask over everything. I think that's disingenuous, but I still try to come with this energy for the students. And sometimes, more often than not, getting into that mode and seeing the students' engagement kind of winds me up, and I'll leave the class feeling better than when I left it.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm going to paraphrase My dad quotes this line a lot. I think it's from Jerry Seinfeld that, you know, like he said, if I only did shows when I was completely 100% happy all the time, I'd only have done like two or three shows in my life. So, I mean, I don't think I'm quit completely on that end, but you know, it is interesting, like knowing where you're at before you go talk to people, recognizing the state of mind that you're in is really important, how on you are.
Yes.
Yeah.
We've definitely had recordings before where we've had to discuss beforehand of like, maybe let's just do the news today. And right. I think I have enough energy for the news, and then we'll get to the rest of the episode later this week or something. Because yeah we want to make sure that we actually have the energy to give a, you know, if not the best version of ourselves, but a better version of ourselves than when we're kind of regretting doing what we're doing in the moment because we're not in the mood.
Speaking of this aspect of the sort of preparation and the mindset, I did want to ask, Dylan, to what extent is your podcast, Is Bedrock, scripted?
It is entirely scripted.
Okay.
A typical life of an episode is this. I'm at the point now where one episode will pretty naturally flow into another, or I have an idea of what arcs are going on. Mm-hmm. At the moment for season two, I'm alternating between what's going on Earth and what's going on in space, because even though I love Earth rocks a lot, it could almost be like, well, these rocks are here in this spot of Canada, and these rocks are a little bit different in this spot of Canada. So to sort of pepper up in between, I'm going up to like the atmosphere and then back down to Earth. And then the next one's going up to the moon. So the broadest point is figuring out what the flow is naturally. Does it make more sense to go into life here? Does it make more sense to go back into space? And once I've figured out a topic that I want to do that I can summarize in about half an hour or so, then I go into the literature. I look over anything that I might have missed. And sometimes that's scholar stuff. And sometimes that's more public science stuff to get like the, you know, the hook as far as what's really interesting about this.
Yeah.
Like I just did an episode on rare earth elements and rare earth metals. And these are elements where even 10, 15, 20 years ago, people might not have heard about these, but you'll hear a lot about them now as far as geopolitics, like Greenland's got them, China's got them. And so trying to hook people in with, it's like, hey, listen in the news, you'll hear about these things. So after I've got all that together, I divide my episodes into three sections, usually like an intro section, a middle sort of getting into the meat of it, and then kind of an outro conclusion section. And I script that, I write that out. Depending on the topic, I can like write one out in a day, or maybe it takes more than a week.
Yeah.
When I'm comfortable with that, I go to the microphone, I record it, sometimes re-record it. And but long story short, to answer your question, it's all scripted. Maybe I'll change a word here or there, but I find it helps me get into the rhythm of things and prepare myself.
Yeah.
Nice.
I ask because it's an interesting contrast to our podcast, which is outlined. You know, we have notes, we have a structure and an outline ready. But the actual words that happen in the podcast are very conversational, which is an intentional choice on our part. Mm-hmm. And that is the case with a lot of science communication podcasts. A lot of the other people we talk to in this series is much more of that sort of conversational or interview style. And I think it's interesting to draw a comparison between, because as always, neither way I think is better or worse effective in science communication. But I think that they do have their place. We choose that sort of conversational style in part because it lends a type of engagement to it. It feels like you're part of the conversation. It's also easier in some ways because that, you know, it cuts down. There's no writing time. We just go right into it.
I've interviewed folks as well. I've done two interviews on the show, and I find that those are very simple as well. I've given them a list of topics to go through. We talk through it. I do the editing. And I thought about conversation versus the sort of solo style that I do. Part of the reason was when I started this, I was living in France and I didn't really have like a good like conversation partner. I mean, I could have found one, but I was living by myself. And a lot of the other researchers I knew didn't quite have the time. I was very privileged to, as a postdoc, to have a bit more free time. So if you look at the timestamps for all of my episodes, these early ones, like one every week, and then you can sort of tell when I became a first professor, because that first semester I did nothing. I actively said, no, I have active work to do. But then now that I've been semester four, it's probably never going to be back on the week by week basis, but every couple of weeks gives me that flow. But I, you know, if more people are interested in coming and talking, I'm happy to do this conversational flow. Again, both ways are valid. I really took a cue more from the history side of things.
Yeah. Well, I think that there is something very nice about having the words laid out, especially if you're making a narrative, especially if you want it to flow. And also if you're only one person talking.
Yes.
You know, it's hard to have a conversation with one person.
Yeah. Modulate my voice just a little bit or something.
Right. Right.
Yes.
I've always admired different SciComers that I, you know, watch on YouTube or see on sometimes like TikTok and stuff that have that scripted thing. Cause it does have, it has a very nice, like, documentary feel to it for me. And I've always also admired it myself because I am not particularly skilled at that. I can learn a script very well, but then it if I don't have it down right away, I overthink it in the moment. Whereas if I'm able to be a bit more ad lib, then I'm less nervous. I'm not getting the words wrong because the words don't exist yet, so I can't get them wrong as long as I say the right, you know, specifics of the age and the size and the name of whatever animal we're talking about. But so it's always a technique that I enjoy and appreciate when people use it.
I tried to do a more bare bones outline at different points. Those did not make it to the final stage because for me, I mean, it's almost like this flood of information and it's hard for me to pick what comes out and I always go back. And so for me, I just, you know, cut out the middleman, cut out that intermediate stage and crafting the writing, crafting that, the story over time, as you said, I can find that flow. And also I always end my sessions with like a summary because, you know, even though I try to spice it up, I try to have music and, you know, effects and all that. You listen to somebody talk by themselves for 20 minutes straight, you might drift off at points. And I get that. So at the end of every episode, I try to say, hey, here's the important stuff that we learned. We'll recap next episode and go on from there. And people seem to like those recaps.
Nice. Yeah. No, that's a good idea.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We were talking earlier about the sort of interest bias in different topics and how it affects us as science communicators, because you have to find a new angle on bringing people into an understanding and an engagement in certain topics. And I wanted to circle back to this conversation because I think another way that it impacts us as science communicators, not only on the communicating side, but on the getting the information side. So with the earliest Earth history, not only doesn't get, you know, sort of the press attention that you get with more recent stuff, more dynamic fossils and things like that, it doesn't get the research attention as other things. And part of that is because there's just not as much material in many cases. There's a lot less from the Hadean than there is from the Pleistocene. That's simply the way that geology works. But that interest bias also affects scientists and it affects where grant money goes and it affects all those things. It is, in some ways, easier to study dinosaurs than it is to study the earliest fossil record and the earliest rocks on Earth. What do you find to be, so sort of what's your perspective on science communication when it comes not just to things that aren't perceived as interesting, but things where there simply isn't as much information or attention to work with?
That's a great question that I will be tackling in a couple seasons. I know there's a season in mind that comes up exactly addressing this problem that you mentioned. It's the Mesoarchaeum, the sort of middle part of the Archean. And so if you look at the Archean, right now we're at the Eoarchean, Paleoarchean. So for reference, we're talking like we're right now in the podcast or on March on the Earth calendar, and the Archean lasts until roughly June and July. It's like the springtime of the Earth. And so people are really interested in the old stuff, like the oldest fossil, the oldest continent, the oldest X, Y, and Z. The end of the Archean is when oxygen is really starting to ramp up. Now, that's a whole other debate and can of worms, but we start to have more rocks, And we start to have more stories of like, this is the Earth that is slowly becoming ours now. And then the middle of this is this weird dark period in Earth history. First of all, there are fewer rocks, definitely fewer studied locations. I've been very privileged to be part of teams opening this window up in northern Canada. Shout out to my former boss, Stefan Lalonde. So I've heard firsthand had to deal with how do we talk about a time where we don't have a lot of rocks to deal with. And I like to set it up like a mystery novel. And to shout out another person, my PhD advisor, Dr. Frank Corsetti at the University of Southern California, would always describe setting up any paper that you do like a mystery novel. There's something important that's happening. There's a hook. And part of the hook for these time periods is the mystery of it itself. Like it's a lot of people are interested in various parts of human history where we have very little information, like the Bronze Age collapse. It's very similar for these parts of Earth history too. You've got this beautiful window into the Earth's oldest fossils, and then this weird nebulous time in between. So to come back and answer your question more directly, sometimes the mystery itself and leaving that open-ended question is kind of the hook. And I usually like to say, well, if you're interested in this topic and if you're a scientist, you know, go out and be that next discoverer.
Yes.
Especially if you're the right audience for that. I know not everybody has the luxury of traveling up to the Canadian Northwoods and hunting for rocks, but sometimes these are the hardest periods to talk about, but the fact that they are so nebulous can sometimes be alluring in themselves.
Yeah, that can be the conversation of why do we know so little and why are they so hard to puzzle out?
Exactly. And those conversations usually are the ones that turn into, oh, we're going to go discover something, right? Like they might be difficult conversations to have or short conversations to have, but if no one has them, no one's going to go out and fill in these gaps in the first place. Mm-hmm. Somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, I think that's a great angle on how do we deal with this comes up in talking with tour guides when I'm training tour guides, and they like to ask the question, what if someone asks a question and I don't know the answer? What if someone asks a question and no one knows the answer?
Yeah.
And I always like to say, great, because now you have this incredible opportunity to talk about why we don't know the answer or how we might find the answer. Those gaps are often a great opportunity to now. All right, well, now we don't have results to talk about. So let's talk about methods. Let's talk about hypotheses, you know, that like you were saying before, hypotheses that were wrong. Right. This idea that we had about that and it was wrong. And well, what was right? Well, that's the part we're still working on. That's the area where we're not sure yet.
There's a recurring segment on the show. I don't even like give it a name, but it's usually I call it the Is This Your Blank? I've got this classic like dating game sort of theme music in the background for this. Like, I've done Is This Your Moon? Is This Your Atmosphere? And those are the segments where if you've listened to them, I, you know, go through, you know, contestant one, contestant two, you know, who came up with them, and usually just knocking them down, but also showing that, one, it's a process, but two, each step gets us closer towards, you know, something more concrete. I usually say, well, why the heck did I tell you all about these failed hypotheses? And I say, well, each of them taught us a little bit more something new or gave us a new technique that we then used in the future. Sometimes it's just really funny to see, you know, what works and what didn't and what people used to think. Like a comment I get a lot in my classes, I teach the story of plate tectonics. And a lot of people think, wait a minute, like plate tectonics as an idea wasn't really like solidified until the 70s. Like my parents would have barely learned about that. Like as old as the material we're looking at is there's fundamental parts of geology that make us the new kids on the block compared to like, you know, Galileo and astronomy and everything else. It's a very young science, weirdly enough, in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that it becomes so important when we're communicating about topics like this in sciences like this to be transparent about those areas of ongoing development and uncertainty. And I often feel like it can be difficult. There is this innate sense of portraying the science as uncertain or in flux or debated can make it seem unreliable.
It can undermine it.
Yeah. I think it's something I often find myself thinking, I think people who are in science tend to get very excited about the mutability of science. People, because that's one of the hallmarks of science, right? Is that it isn't set in stone, so to speak. It can, we can update it. We're always refining and we're always adjusting. We were wrong about some stuff. Sometimes we were hilariously wrong about stuff and we continue to grow. And that's very exciting. But I often wonder, for how many people is that, does that feel like a barrier? Does that feel like a problem?
Disconcerting.
Right. Where they say, well, you know, well, then what's the point? How can we trust anything that I'm learning in science right now if tomorrow it's just going to change? And trying to find the way to be open about that flux and about the newness of some ideas and about the constant process of refinement and updating, while also reassuring people that the information we have is good information and the techniques we're using are good. Letting people know that science isn't, the information we have isn't for sure, but don't worry about that. Well, you don't have to run away.
That the info may get corrected and isn't always sure, but the process is still a good process that we're using to correct and find out that info was not solid and to get to the better info.
And it's also important to put stuff in context. Like, we're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater most of the mm-hmm, time. Mm-hmm. Usually, like, we're keeping that baby. I'm not going to pull this metaphor too long, but what to say is this, is that the fundamental core of the problem or the solution to that problem, we can mostly agree with. We are quibbling on usually the sort of window dressing on this, mm-hmm. on this stuff. And to show like what the really important is that we still don't know, and what the stuff is that like, okay, like you, the listener, have the idea down. I'm going to go off on some tangents, but you get the idea at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also, I liked your contestant way of setting it up, because to me that feels like it also hits at something that I always like to try to emphasize when teaching these kinds of things to people, in that I think there's some of the hesitance and discomfort around those aspects of science, like you were saying, come from the, you know, how can I trust any of it, but also that for many, many people there is a great discomfort with being wrong, mm-hmm. and that science being wrong, or you being wrong, or saying the wrong thing because you learned something, is a big discomfort and insecurity for a lot of people. And I like to emphasize that in science, it is okay to make a mistake as long as you're willing to correct it. And as long as you're always open to updating it. And that many times those old ideas that seem silly and goofy now, at the time they were dealing with the information they had. And that was just the best answer they were able to see with what they had in front of them. You know, they weren't necessarily just being goofballs. They were doing science completely legitimately, but they just lacked info that later on came to light, or techniques that allowed them to see it in a new way that didn't exist at the time.
Another thing I like about the contestant approach is it emphasizes that there are options.
Mm-hmm.
I often find myself bristling a little bit when I'll hear people describe like, oh, we don't know the origins of life. We don't understand that. And they'll say, well, we still have no idea how life got started. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, that's not true. Here are the ideas. We have actually very, very good ideas. We don't know which of them is correct. Mm-hmm. We don't know all of the answers to those. I like the contestants because we get to go, yeah, here's the three of them. Mm-hmm. Most likely it's one of these three.
Yes.
Right. And maybe there's a dark horse contender that we haven't even figured out yet because of the technology we may or may not have. One interesting, I wouldn't say quandary, but a fine line I have to make as far as past hypotheses. It's one thing to say, oh, you know, George Darwin in the 1800s got this idea wrong. But there are some topics where I'm talking about relatively recent research that has been since disproven, and these researchers are still out there doing their thing. The most recent, or the big one that comes to mind, is looking at these crystals called the Jackhill zircons, the oldest minerals on Earth, about 4.4 billion mid-January on the calendar. And there was a recent study about a decade or so ago that apparently found diamonds embedded within these zircons. And well, diamonds are carbon, and the train of thought, which goes into more detail, is that, well, maybe that carbon came from life.
Mm-hmm.
The end result of this story is that those diamonds were embedded from polishing grit. They were basically, as they were polishing these tough, tough crystals down, they needed to use diamond. Some of that diamond got embedded into these old zircons. New diamonds shoved inside old zircons. And another team brought that up. But the old researchers, or the previous researchers, were included in there. And I make very great pains to say, you know, this happens. I'm not calling anyone out on this, but this is sometimes how science goes. And I've described sometimes personal, like I've had papers that take years to come out because of the peer review process. So trying to find the line where, you know, giving everyone the benefit of the doubt and trying to say, hey, this is how science rolls. We all have to work together to move forward on this.
Yeah. Stressing that collaborative nature and stressing the people part of science is such an important part of that. That reliability aspect of building trust is putting faces on it.
Well, and we run into this when we talk about like historical figures and wanting, you know, as we've mentioned during this conversation, of wanting to be open and honest while approaching these topics, that you do have to sometimes acknowledge, like, yeah, sometimes just actual oopses happen. Mm-hmm. Like throughout the history of science, people are the ones doing it, and sometimes a ball gets dropped. It's not always...
Humans, famously fallible.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that can sometimes be a difficult one to face on, wanting to both be respectful of the human who made said mistake. Yes.
Especially if it wasn't still alive. Yes. They're like, yeah, this is John. John made this mistake.
And as long as it wasn't a malicious, you know, action, while also trying to be clear to the listeners that this does not mean this person is a bad scientist, or that this science is nonsense because it got messed up one time. Mm-hmm. Just that we have to be vigilant of these things, just like you would for construction workers. Like at some point, someone's going to make a mistake, but that's why you hopefully have multiple of you there to catch it before the building's done. You know, that's just how it goes.
Absolutely. I love the construction worker analogy because they're doing very important physical building stuff. As a scientist, it sometimes feel like we get extra flack because people point to us and want us as like the pure uncut truth.
Yes.
But, you know, we try our best, but we're building these ideas like building a building. Mm-hmm. And it takes time and it takes mistakes. And I really like that analogy.
While we're talking about the scientific process and sort of really understanding the work that scientists put in, Dylan, I have pulled this sentence off of your website that I would like to put to you. Mm-hmm. And I think this is part of the mission statement or the description of the podcast, where you say that you hope for your audience to build a mental toolkit to see the world like a geologist. Explain. What do you mean?
Yeah, I remember writing that when I first did that statement. If you go onto the website, bedrockpodcast.com, you can find the transcripts and you can also find this statement there. Mental toolkit is one word for it. When I talk about it to my students, I also call it the geology goggles.
Oh, I like that. That's a lot of fun.
It was like beer goggles.
Yep.
Yeah.
The thing is this, especially at the beginning of these classes, I very much hammer in observation and interpretation, the differences between these two. And I start just by having them describe their observations. What do you see in this rock? And I say, I mean, what you see in this rock is what you see. There are no wrong answers. You know, just describe what you see. They were not interpreting it yet. And I also like to tell them that you'll probably see something that I haven't seen because I've got my own view of it. This is typically associated with the Polish proverb that the guest sees in 10 minutes what the host misses in 10 years or something like that. Us being so familiar with these rocks, we're so ingrained in how we were taught, but somebody with no geologic background could point out something that, one, not only did we not see, but two, oh, that might actually be a really, really important thing that we were really ingrained with. But to come back to that, over the years, I've been very privileged to have great mentors teach me how to look at a rock and just observe it before I interpret it. And then as I'm interpreting it, what skills am I using? What toolkits? How am I reaching these conclusions? So what the show is trying to do, especially in these early days, is when you see a certain type of rock, and if you see it has patterns in this way, let's say it's got these weird squiggly zebra stripes, how can you tell if those are stripes that formed at the bottom of the ocean? How can you tell if these were stripes that formed as the rocks were compressed? And giving them this basic idea of, well, if it looks like X, it probably could be Y. Just breaking it down into these ideas of what are you seeing? What are we both seeing? And telling you, well, here's what I see. And now you can see the same thing too. And now you've got these geology goggles. It's usually easier when you have a rock in person there with you, like teaching a laboratory.
Yep, yep.
But even for something like the moon, we talk about how the moon formed this huge, titanic, in very many ways, an abstract idea for an object the size of Mars to hit the Earth. But when you look at the moon, you can see different colored rocks, and I describe how these different colored rocks got there and how you can see these rocks by yourself every day. And that's just one example of, I try to pick household objects and I use food analogies all the time. What do you see in the world around you? And how can you apply that to a mountainside, a cliffside, a very ancient fossil? That's the toolkit I'm talking about. Everybody's got this toolkit. It's just having folks realize that they can use it, that folks do think like scientists every single day.
Very, I really like that. It this is a slight tangent, but it makes me think of a scene in the docudrama From Earth to the Moon, where they went through all the processes that happened for the first moon landings. A great series, if no one's ever seen it. It was like spearheaded by Tom Hanks after he did Apollo 13 and got super into the moon landing. But there's a section when one of the next team of astronauts that are going to go to the moon are going to go do some geologic surveys and that, but none of them are geologists. And so they had to meet with a geologist so he could teach them how to look at the moon like a geologist, so that they could do the correct science that, you know, and come out with the proper goggles to actually make bring back insights from the moon that they wouldn't have been able to without that intro. And it had a great moment where, like, when they are meeting with mission control before, they're like, all right, we should actually land here, because from what we've learned, this will actually give us a much better series of sample sites and things like that. And so it was a scene capturing very much what you're seeing of you, this is a mentality that you can learn.
Yes. And mentality you can learn and foster. To go a little bit more of what I do in class, is most science classes in high school and undergrad are almost obliged to talk about the scientific method, you know, and all the steps. And I do talk about that. But before I do, I boil it down to, again, observation, interpretation. And what I try to do to encourage these students, most of them are not geology majors, most of them are not science majors. And a lot of them come in with this hesitancy, this anxiety around science. And what I do is say, you are thinking like a scientist every day, you just don't realize it. You are jumping through the stages of the scientific process because you have the real world experience. The example I use is this. Okay, so you're driving around in your car and you see that somebody has veered off the road and they're heading in your direction, like they're incoming collision, right? You observe that someone is coming towards you. Now, if you did all the steps of the scientific method in order, it's like, well, you know what, maybe they're drunk and how do I test this? Now that by the time that happens, you are in a head-on collision. What you do is immediately jump to interpretation. You immediately jump to, okay, I got to swerve my way out. Same thing with in a less dramatic situation in the kitchen. I use the example of my eggs smell bad. Observation. Now you could do the whole step of the scientific method, but you jump to the interpretation based on real world experience that those eggs are probably rotten. So what I do is say scientists are doing what you've done. You're more efficient in many ways and asking those questions. And we are like little tiny babies breaking them up into a bunch of different sequences of steps. You're doing it efficiently. But we're trying to answer questions where, like, what is the center of the Earth made of? How is the moon made of? Where you need to start to pick it apart more. But it all starts with, as you said, looking at the moon, what type of rocks are there? Then we can answer the bigger questions.
Well, and I like your comparison that when you do the scientific method in your day-to-day, you're basing it off of things you already know, you know, or that you've already been taught. And with science, we are often dealing with situations where we don't have those experiences. You know, what is the center of the Earth made of? Well, no one's been there, and we've not been to any other centers of planets. So we have to break it down into all the steps of trying to answer that question because we do not have the reference material. And that's why we have to use that tool that way, because we can't just go, oh, well, like every other time this has ever happened, this is surely the answer. We have to go, well, we can't see it, or this is the first time we've, you know, measured this thing. So we need to meticulously go through and really try to make sure we're coming to the correct answer.
Building off from there, once I get them comfortable with this idea of observation, I then go into plate tectonics, which is a great example of the scientific method and all the pitfalls. I fast forward to when Marie Tharp is finally making her maps of the seafloor, and I just throw up the maps themselves. And they'll often have heard that we know more about the surface of the moon than the bottom of the ocean. We can debate that. But I say, let's say that you are the first person to actually see what the bottom of the seafloor looks like. I'm putting you in Marie's shoes. I'm putting you in everybody's shoes. You're going to ask the same questions that they will. Take a second and look at it. What do you see? And so they chat a bit, and they'll it's something new every single time from what they see, something that I might not have even noticed in the first place. So again, trying to put them in the shoes of what you are doing now is what scientists are doing every single day. We usually just have fancier toys to do it with.
Yes.
I really enjoy the framing of learning about the tools that you have to look at the world around you and ask and answer questions about it. It ties in very nicely with what we talked about way back in the beginning of our discussion about drawing people in with questions they didn't know they could ask. Teaching students about the world to think like a geologist by showing them that they have the tools to ask questions they may have never considered before. I think that's a really powerful entry into science and scientific thinking and scientific understanding. Dylan, you are, I think you said, currently on the podcast in the Eoarchean.
That is correct.
You're in the, what, February, March on your calendar?
We've just crossed into March, and we've just passed into the 3-point-somethings billion. We'll have a couple more back in the fours, but we are really moving on. Yes, we're in about the middle of season two right now.
All right. Nice. So you have, in addition to setting yourself the daunting task of tackling the unexplored, you know, the underrepresented and underexplored early parts of Earth history, you have also set yourself the daunting task of doing what sounds like several seasons of this podcast. I think if I remember right on your website, you've got it listed out to like 8 seasons.
Yes, it'll be 8. Those 8 seasons are chosen for a reason. Each one is a real slice of geologic time that we do. So season 1 was the Hadean. Seasons 2, 3, 4, and 5 are the Archean, and then 6, 7, 8 are the Proterozoic. And those slices in the last ones are so long that I might even have to subdivide them more. But
I was going to say, a lot happens in the Proterozoic.
A lot happens, absolutely. So as we get into more and more rocks, I'm thinking about shifting the focus. Right now, if you listen to the podcast, the arcs usually are tied to very specific places, like the Jack Hill zircons in Australia. We just did the oldest rocks in Canada and are working our way east through Canada now, and we'll get to Greenland. But let's say in seasons 6, 7, 8, these are areas where we have all these rocks around the world, and I don't have the luxury to talk about every single rock in every single location and every single continent. So the arc there is definitely going to more be, instead of specific zones, like playing Battleship with the really, really old stuff, is more focused on these larger trends, like the evolution of eukaryotic organisms, and eventually, you know, the Ediacaran, all the, you know, the, oh, stuff you can actually see, right? I mean, it's still going to be me, and it's still the general process, the half-hour podcast is going to be the same, but I think that the nature of the arcs is going to change necessarily as we get more material than I could possibly do a blow-by-blow discussion on. But it's fun to do this deep dive into a certain spot now while we have the luxury of it.
Cool. So you've done the first couple seasons, 500 million years, mm-hmm. With 3.5 billion years to go.
Yes. And the timing has slowed down. I'll be the first to admit that. Like I mentioned,
oh, sure.
The whole semester. Again, it's been about 2 weeks since I posted the last one. The script is all ready. I'm going to record that this weekend, and hopefully it'll pop up on Monday. But people have been very, no one's really given me too much flack about it. I, as I'm making this show for the listeners, but I also have to respect my own time. And absolutely, you know, always. In the early days, I thought, oh no, it's always got to be a week. If I miss a week, you know, it has blown me away how much this show has grown. And the fact that y'all are even talking to me about it right now and how the numbers have gone up. I don't use Twitter. I don't use Instagram. I don't use TikTok. I have a personal Facebook that I very rarely use. I really am not on social media, and that's a personal choice. I knew that going into this. But the fact that this thing is still caught on as much as it has, just me doing my thing, has... I can't even begin to describe what that feels like, and that people will let me do this on my own time while I'm still teaching and doing my own research and mentoring students. The fact that I can still do this is a privilege beyond words.
Well, congratulations on your success so far.
Thank you.
Best of luck in the billions of years to come that you have to cover. Shout out to, I don't remember who it was, unfortunately, someone on our Discord shared your podcast, and that was the first that I had heard of it, and I looked into it, and that led to us inviting you to join us today. And I saw this and I thought, I have long thought about, and we've had listeners suggest the idea of doing a series where we go through the different geologic time periods, and we could do an episode on the Cambrian and the Ordovician, and, you know, just go through all of it. And I've seen other series like that. And I saw your podcast and I thought, oh, thank goodness, we can start at the Cambrian.
Yes.
we can start at the Cambrian and say, hey, the rest of it, that's been done.
Yes.
Here's these 8 seasons that this other person has already done an incredible job on.
Let us introduce you to Dylan.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for the shout out. And for my own shout out as well, I want to shout out Rochelle Verna, who basically gave me the platform to do this in the first place, the podcast hosting platform, and for my good friend Joyce Yeager for sort of kicking me in the butt. I'd been thinking about this in grad school several years ago, but talking to both Rochelle and Joyce really got me out there. And of course, all of my professors, especially Dr. Stephen Darmbos, Dr. Frank Corsetti, Dr. Stefan Lalonde, Mark Van Zalen, for not only teaching me research, but emphasizing science communication, science education. I would not be doing this, or not nearly half as well, without their guidance.
Fantastic. Dylan, thank you so much for joining us on this series. Before we end all of it, please, if you would, let our listeners know where they can find you. And if you have any other projects or exciting things to shout out, go for it.
Absolutely. You can find the podcast Bedrock, Earth's Earliest History, pretty much anywhere you get your podcasts on. Rating and reviewing always helps the show. If you would like or require visible transcripts, you can find all of those on bedrockpodcast.com. I'm a little bit behind on those, but I've just started season 2 there. The best way to reach me personally is through a Gmail account, bedrock.mailbox@gmail.com. I always get lots of great fan mail there. I'd love to hear what you think about the show.
Fantastic. Listeners, check out Dylan's podcast, Bedrock, for all of your pre-Cambrian curiosities. And keep your ears out for the other episodes of this series, Spotlight 2024, where we will be sitting down with yet more of our SciComm fellows to talk about science communication. Dylan, one more time, thank you very much for joining us on this episode. It's been a great time chatting with you.
This is lovely.
Thank you very much, David and Will. It's been a pleasure and an honor to be here.
And with that, we'll insert some sort of deep time geology pun here.
Yes.
In post for sure.
Perfect.
And we'll see everybody later.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to the Common Descent Podcast. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and check our WordPress blog for pictures and links after each episode. Huge thanks to our patrons, whose support helps keep this podcast running and who get access to bonus goodies on Patreon. The song you're hearing is called On the Origin of Species by Protodome, which we found at ocremix.org. Thanks again for listening. We hope you'll join us next time.